looking for a house.
The police chief in Ferguson, Missouri, sparked more unrest last night when he tried to join protesters outside City Hall after issuing an apology to the family of Michael Brown. Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff.
And I'm Gwen Ifill. Also ahead, Ukraine and Russia strike a deal on natural gas to keep Ukrainians warm through the winter. But in an interview with the NewsHour, Ukraine's prime minister said he's skeptical that President Putin will keep his promises.
I'm very skeptical about Russia and the Russian president. I just don't trust them.
Then migrant youth caught by the U.S. Border Patrol wait for their day in court while attending American public schools.
They're all arriving poor, facing English language limitations that are very serious, and many of them arriving facing social and psychological needs, no doubt because of the conditions they left behind in their countries.
And it's Friday. Mark Shields and David Brooks are here to analyze the week's news. Those are just some of the stories we're covering on tonight's PBS NewsHour.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by...
For 160 years, BNSF, the engine that connects us.
I've been around long enough to recognize the people who are out there owning it. The ones getting involved and staying engaged. They're not afraid to question the path they're on. Because the one question they never want to ask is, how did I end up here? I started Schwab for those people. People who want to take ownership of their investments like they do in every other aspect of their lives.
And by BAE Systems, inspired work. And with the ongoing support of these institutions.
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
5 days of U.S. and Arab airstrikes in Syria have done serious damage to Islamic State forces. That word today from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Army General Martin Dempsey. He said the militants' command and control and logistics are now disrupted. Dempsey also said with enough manpower, Western-backed rebels in Syria could finish off Islamic State or ISIL.
There has to be a ground component to the campaign against ISIL in Syria, and we believe that the path to develop that is the Syrian moderate opposition. 5,000's never been the end state. We've had estimates anywhere from 12,000 to 15,000 is what we believe they would need to recapture lost territory in eastern Syria.
Meanwhile, Islamic State forces were able to press their offensive to seize the town of Kobani near the Syrian-Turkish border. Kurdish fighters have been struggling to hold that area.
The U.S.-led coalition against Islamic State forces won new support today. The British House of Commons voted overwhelmingly to join the air campaign in Iraq, but not in Syria. We get a report from Gary Gibbon of Independent Television News.
The RAF is now expected to join the attacks over the weekend, but only on targets inside Iraq. David Cameron told MPs the Islamic State forces were a threat Britain could not ignore.
Left unchecked, we will face a terrorist caliphate on the shores of the Mediterranean and bordering a NATO member with a declared and proven determination to attack our country and our people. This is not the stuff of fantasy. It is happening in front of us, and we need to face up to it.
This is multilateral action, prompted by a legitimate democratic state. And a world order governed by rules, if it is about anything, must be about protecting a democratic state, which is what this motion before us is about. I believe although this is difficult, it is the right thing to do.
After negotiations with the coalition behind the scenes, the Labour leader Ed Miliband brought the vast bulk of his party on side. But a vocal minority of MPs challenged the Prime Minister that even with this limited action proposed today, he was at risk of repeating the mistakes of the past.
ISIS indeed are made up of murderous psychopaths. That's not the issue. We know that. Iraq, Afghanistan, in this government, Libya, none are success stories. Are we going to embark on action that could last for years?
The fact is, this is about psychopathic terrorists that are trying to kill us, and we do have to realise that whether we like it or not, they have already declared war on us. There isn't a walk-on-by option. There isn't an option of just hoping this will go away.
Six RAF Tornado jets based in Cyprus are expected to be involved in a short burst of attacks in Iraq, potentially followed by more in the weeks to come. US jets yesterday heading for Syria and Iraq. Labour and the coalition agree with the US that combat troops should not be deployed. Ed Miliband, though, said he worried that while the Iraqi army would try to occupy the vacuum left after attacks on Islamic State forces in Iraq, in Syria, no one knew who would benefit.
Now, in the case of Iraq, it is the Iraqi army and the Kurds who can conduct those operations. There is, I put it no higher than this, there is an outstanding question about who will perform that function in Syria.
One minister said that over time, the British public would be won over to the idea of attacking Syrian targets. The truth is, no one truly knows what military efforts will be needed, how much time it will take to defeat this very unconventional enemy.
Belgium and Denmark also approved contributions to the airstrikes in Iraq. Belgium will send six fighter jets, the Danes, seven.
The State Department is telling Americans to leave Yemen amid fears of all-out civil war. The announcement today also says the U.S. diplomatic staff in the country will be reduced. Shiite rebels have been battling Sunni militias for control of the capital. The pro-American government is caught in between.
In Afghanistan, security officials warned that hundreds of Taliban fighters are close to capturing a key district and could use it as a base to attack Kabul. Scores of people have died in the fighting in part of Ghazni province. That's just 60 miles from the capital city. Police say the militants have beheaded at least a dozen people.
The Russian government moved today to take over another major oil company. A court in Moscow approved seizing the majority interest owned by billionaire Vladimir Yevtushenkov. He has been under house arrest for 10 days, accused of acquiring the company illegally. The case echoes the seizure of the giant Yukos oil firm a decade ago.
Flights in and out of Chicago's two airports were stopped for nearly 5 hours today because of a fire. The resulting delays and cancellations rippled across the nation's midsection. The blaze broke out at an air traffic control center in the suburbs of Chicago. Police say it was set by a worker who then stabbed himself.
We located a male suffering from non-gun-related self-inflicted wounds. We evacuated about 15 to 30 people from the building, extinguished the fire. There was no explosion, but we are being cautious, and that's why you're seeing a lot of equipment come in.
Authorities have ruled out terrorism as a factor in the fire.
About 70% of the migrants caught at the Mexican border this summer have now vanished into the U.S. According to the Associated Press, the Department of Homeland Security acknowledged as much in a private meeting this week. The migrants were released and told to report to federal immigration agents within 15 days. As many as 41,000 never did.
In economic news, growth hit an annual rate of 4.6% in the spring, the best in more than 2 years. That news helped Wall Street bounce back today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 167 points to close at 17,113. The Nasdaq rose 45 points to close at 4,512, and the S&P 500 added almost 17 points to finish near 1983. But for the week, the Dow lost 1%. The Nasdaq and S&P were down about 1.5%.
Still to come on the News Hour, why anger persists in Ferguson, Missouri. Ukraine's prime minister on steps forward for meaningful peace with Russia. How a surge in migrant children is challenging public schools. saying goodbye to New York Yankees star Derek Jeter, and Mark Shields and David Brooks on the week's news.
We return our attention now to Ferguson, Missouri, where an unarmed black teenager was killed last month by a white police officer, sparking protests and continuing unrest up to and including last night.
It started Tuesday night with gunshots and looting after fire destroyed an impromptu shrine to Michael Brown. Then yesterday, Ferguson Police Chief Thomas Jackson issued a video apology to the Brown family nearly 6 weeks after the shooting.
I'm truly sorry for the loss of your son. I'm also sorry that it took so long to remove Michael from the street. The time that it took involved very important work on the part of investigators who are trying to collect evidence and gain a true picture of what happened that day. But it was just too long, and I'm truly sorry for that.
Last night, Jackson emerged in civilian clothes and marched with the protesters. But a fight broke out, and in the end, seven people were arrested. All of this as a grand jury continues investigating Brown's death. St. Louis County Prosecutor Bob McCulloch said this week the panel should finish by early November.
I went to Ferguson last weekend and to the Lee Theater at the University of Missouri in St. Louis to moderate a PBS town hall on what the conflict there revealed about the town, the region, and the nation. Among other things, it gave people who see events differently a chance to talk to each other rather than at each other. In this excerpt, the point has just been made that young people of color should get more involved in politics. The first speaker is a young man who formed a group called Dream Defenders after Trayvon Martin's death in Florida 2 years ago.
One of the last things that Dr. King said before he died was that he feared that he had brought us into a burning building. And so if you're getting people elected into a system that by its very nature was meant to cannibalize and kill communities, then you've only done half of the job. And so I think it's a yes and. We need people that look like us, but black officers. I've had interactions with black officers that were way worse than white officers. It's not a matter of just having a representative that's on the city council or in the mayor's office or on the police force that looks like you. They've got to come from the community, know the issues of the community. And then there's folks in the community that got to remind them every day that we pay your bills. And we're watching every single day to ensure that the platform on which we elected you with is followed. And also defend you when those people that seek to calibrate the system and write the system as it's been built seek to come at you for that office.
Now, here's the thing, Philip. Everybody doesn't agree with you. Everybody doesn't see the root of the problem. Ross Kaminsky is one of them. Ross Kaminsky writes for American Spectator. And he thinks, in fact, that a lot of folks should be looking at themselves in the mirror.
I want to be really clear on this because I agree with what the mayor of Ferguson said, that, middle-class white guys like me haven't lived the African-American life. That said, from what we see on the news, from what we read, there seems to be a real dearth of leadership among African-American young men, especially in their neighborhoods. And the other thing is, if I could react to what Philip said, I get the feeling, I understand this feeling of this system isn't fair. It's biased against us. But then when you start going to this idea, 400 years of repression in a system that's still designed to hurt us and still designed to keep us down, that starts feeling to me like racism against me just because of the color of my skin. My parents weren't here 400 years ago. My family arrived here way after the Civil War. We had nothing to do with it. And I think that a lot of people in the rest of America feel like we're being blamed for things that we didn't cause, and in fact that we would like to help because we should care.
For everybody who's laughing and snickering, no, let me make a point to you. St. Louis There was a St. Louis County poll done just last week in which roughly 60% of the people said, you know, I think that this is a problem. And those 60% of the people were black. And then 60% of white people said, I don't think it's a problem. There is a real, true divide, and a lot of people who agree with what Ross Kaminsky said. So I want this conversation to take that into account as well, even if you disagree.
Gwen, can I just say, sure. I'm not saying that I don't think there's a problem. I think there's a huge problem, and I think that middle-class white people who don't live near black neighborhoods should understand that it's a problem for them, too. What I'm saying is that the language, when it starts being turned that when it start in a way that even just implies you're the problem because you're white, ends the conversation and removes any chance of a positive conversation.
Is that what you're saying, Phil?
No, absolutely not. So I never mentioned black, white, or people. I mentioned systems. And so the arrest of Darren Wilson, if it happens, and the conviction of Darren Wilson, if it happens, though the system and the history would tell us that it may not, will not alleviate the problems that are happening here and that are happening around the country. This is a, for example, I can sit here with a great amount of empathy and say every day George Zimmerman woke up and saw that black men were evil. Every single day since he was a little kid, he woke up and saw on television, on Cops, on the news, on his TV shows and videos that black men were filled with malice and had criminal intent in every movement that they made. And so with the great amount of empathy, I could say that he may not be to blame for a very subliminal reaction to what he did when he saw a black man in a hoodie, right? I'm not mad so much at George Zimmerman. I'm mad at a system every day that stakes its claim on saying that there's a certain segment of society that is a criminal element. But if I woke up every day, which I do, and they told me that lions were evil, if I saw a lion in here and you told me that lion wasn't going to eat me, I wouldn't believe.
Final.
But George Zimmerman, on the other hand, as I recall, was a big brother to a young black boy. And I don't think there's any evidence to show that he had this pervasive approach that you're talking about.
I think we can't say it, but we can say the evidence does show that the images that are put forth of people that look like me, that have tattoos like me, that speak like me and come from where I come from, scared the crap out of him every single day. And no, he may have been a big brother. He may have been a great person with a spotless record, though we know he doesn't. But the society that we live in, and that is my issue. Our goal with Dream Defenders is to be a catalyst for change in how we are represented in this society.
I'm going to let you say one more thing, then I've got to move on.
I think that we're not going to have progress on this until we really can have a conversation. And the language that needs to be used in the conversation, it needs to be language that isn't just pointing fingers at each other as long as we believe we're all people of goodwill.
That conversation, America After Ferguson, airs on most PBS stations this evening. Check your local listings. Hari Srinivasan will be live tweeting with you throughout. Just use the hashtag AfterFergusonPBS.
There were signs of hope for a peaceful resolution to the conflict in Ukraine today. But as Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent Margaret Warner reports, Ukraine's Prime Minister has reservations.
Relative calm now prevails across much of eastern Ukraine after months of heavy fighting that claimed more than 3,000 lives. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko highlighted the turnabout yesterday.
It is the first day in many, many weeks and months when Ukrainians have not had a single person killed.
On September 5th, Kiev signed a ceasefire blueprint with pro-Russian separatists, including granting more autonomy to Ukraine's eastern regions. It also calls for a buffer zone. Ukraine's military says it met with Russian and separatist officers near Donetsk today to outline it, but the Russians denied being involved. They also deny supplying the separatists nor sending Russian troops to assist, though this summer NATO estimated thousands of Russian combat forces were in Ukraine. This week, the alliance reported a significant drawdown of those troops. Meanwhile, a war of words continues. On Wednesday, President Obama told the UN that Russian aggression in Ukraine threatens world order.
This is a vision of the world in which might makes right, a world in which one's nation's borders can be redrawn by another.
In his speech, Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk urged the U.S. and Europe to maintain sanctions on Russia until his country regains all its territory, including Crimea. I spoke with Prime Minister Yatsenyuk late yesterday in New York.
Mr. Prime Minister, thank you for having us.
It's a privilege for me.
President Poroshenko, your president, said Thursday in Kiev that he thought the worst part of the war was behind you, that he thought actually there had been a transformation, that was his word, in Russia's attitude toward Ukraine. Do you think so?
I'm very skeptical about Russia and the Russian president. I just don't trust them. I do understand their ultimate goal.
Which is?
To recreate Soviet Union, to do something that resembles these Soviet-style empire. But we had limited options on the table, and I do understand the decision that was made by President Poroshenko to start talks in Minsk and to unfold the ceasefire and peace plan. The thing is that whether Russia is ready to execute and to implement this plan, because knowing them, they will just try to pick the cherry, what they want, but not what's needed. But again, I am very skeptical, but it's better to have ceasefire rather than fire.
NATO officials said this week that they had seen significant numbers of Russian troops crossing back into Russia. Does that give you confidence?
We do understand that Russia, at this particular period of time, probably is interested in pulling back some forces. Because Russia faced another problem. Pulling back forces, Russia got coffins from the Ukrainian territory of Russian soldiers. And this severely affected Russian population and an approval rating of Russian president. So if it's true, this is the good news. But again, let's be very cautious. To restore the control over the border, to pull back forces, to stop to support terrorists. These are the three preconditions for further talks.
Now, do you think that President Putin, despite what he says, is feeling the squeeze of the economic sanctions, the sort of multiple sanctions by both the U.S. and the EU, that this is one of the reasons, in addition to the body bags coming back, that he has decided to pull back?
He says that he doesn't care. I would say that I don't trust that he doesn't care. Sanctions definitely have a tough and huge negative impact over the Russian economy. So in the long-term perspective, we do understand that sanctions will severely squeeze the ability and the capability of Russian economy. But we need to find short-term and quick-term solutions.
President Poroshenko was in Washington late last week, and he said, and I quote, "In the condition of war, the economy of Ukraine cannot survive." Now, you're really the man in charge of getting this economy on its feet. Do you agree with that?
It's difficult to find any economy in the world which can flourish having the war. And I can hardly imagine the way how to attract international investors having Russian tanks and soldiers on your soil. The war is very expensive.
For you?
Absolutely.
Now, the latest sanctions that were imposed a couple of weeks ago, the U.S. and EU made very clear that if President Putin carried out the 12-point peace plan, which really has to do with the situation in the East, that those particular sanctions could be lifted. Would you support that?
Let me elaborate over the definition. What does it mean for me to change the course? It means that we restore the control over Ukrainian territory, that we take back Crimea.
That's a big one. President Obama didn't mention taking back Crimea.
But as far as I understand, that's what he is thinking about.
Now, let me ask you about what your parliament passed a couple of weeks ago, which was a kind of limited autonomy for the eastern regions. Is that a prelude to the dissolution of part of Ukraine?
That's what Russia wants. To get another frozen conflict in Europe. We are not allowed to legitimize this frozen conflict.
But if we look ahead, is that the first step to essentially unsettling that whole part of Ukraine, making it impossible for you to have a unified state that would be attractive, say, to the EU?
Well, this is the Russian target. This is the Russian aim. Our aim is to de-escalate the situation, to empower these regions with an additional authority, but to have these regions as an integral part of Ukraine. Not an easy job, but doable.
So as a student of Ukrainian history and Russian history, what do you think it will take for Ukraine to be able to stand up to the Russian bear?
Usually, in my childhood, my mom told me a number of fairy tales. And the bear is a very good animal in Ukrainian fairy tales. But in reality, it's better to have bear somewhere in the zoo.
To have them in the zoo. Mr. Prime Minister, thank you.
Thank you.
As tens of thousands of children have crossed the U.S.-Mexico border in recent months, many of them fleeing violence and poverty in Central America, there have been a lot of questions about what will happen to them. But even as they wait for their day in immigration court, many have enrolled in school. The NewsHour's April Brown looks at the challenges schools and districts are facing. Her report is part of our American Graduate Project.
At the beginning of the school year, Miami's Riverside Elementary was already beyond capacity. And then, says Principal Erica Paramore-Respress, more and more students kept showing up to enroll.
Every day, literally, we have students that are registering, and some are from the neighborhood, and some are from other places outside of the state, but more recently outside of the country, specifically Central America.
More than 70 new students from Central America signed up here over the summer and during the first 2 weeks of school. Officials assume many of them arrived in the wave of unaccompanied minors that recently washed over this country and are awaiting a hearing in immigration court. While they wait, they go to school. And according to federal law, schools are not allowed to ask about students' immigration status. That makes it tough to plan ahead.
How many of you are from Honduras? Please raise your hands.
Many of the new arrivals from this school may have fled drug gangs and violence in Honduras. Belkis Arias arrived from that country a couple of months ago.
It's a little difficult to understand the people who speak English, but I like it here.
Like many other kids who just started at Riverside, Belkis doesn't speak English, and that makes teaching lessons more time-consuming.
So let's look at the first vocabulary word. It says loan, right?
All Riverside instructors know how to teach English as a second language. That's not true in all schools here. But a district-wide problem is finding space for all the extra students.
We have utilized every single space imaginable here in the building. And the only other way that we can continue to grow at this rate is to implement a co-teaching model, which puts two teachers in one classroom. And even that has limitations because there are some classrooms that is just not physically possible to house two teachers in one classroom.
Miami-Dade is the fourth largest district in the country, and it estimates it costs an extra $2,000 per year to provide additional help to each foreign-born student. This year, the federal government gave Miami-Dade a $3.4 million grant to address those costs. But Superintendent Alberto Carvalho says it's not enough to fund special services for the thousands of new arrivals from Latin America.
They're all arriving poor, facing English language limitations. They are very serious. And many of them arriving facing social and psychological needs, no doubt because of the conditions they left behind in their countries, as well as the very harrowing and traumatic journey through Mexico before crossing the border.
Oscar is one of those children. He was 12 when he made the journey from Honduras to the United States with his 17-year-old sister, Melissa. Honduras has the highest murder rate in the world and is among the poorest countries in Latin America. Criminal gangs had threatened them both.
They threatened to rape me or hurt us or do other terrible things if we didn't cooperate with them.
I also came for a reason, the drug traffickers, the crime. The traffickers were looking for kids to smuggle drugs into other countries.
Melissa and Oscar have asked us not to use their real names, and they say the decision to flee their country was an easy one.
I had to do it because I had no other option. If I did not leave my country, I don't know what would have happened to me or my brother.
whether we're talking about the Mariel boat lift, particularly involving Cuba, or more recently, after hurricanes or earthquake destruction in Haiti, the fact that we pick up hundreds, if not thousands, of children. So we know how to do this.
That experience will help Miami-Dade cope with the latest influx of children. But time may test its endurance because the kids may be here quite a while. Melissa and Oscar, for example, were quickly apprehended when they crossed the U.S. border into Texas and were eventually released to a family member in Miami. They were fortunate to find a pro bono attorney to help them make the case for staying in the U.S., but even that may not speed things up. Cheryl Little is the executive director of the South Florida nonprofit Americans for Immigrant Justice.
Cases have been backlogged for years. I mean, I think that the number now is something like 375,000 backlogged cases. We have clients who've waited years and years and years for their day in court. Obviously, that has to change.
Back at Riverside, the mood is upbeat as the school prepares for more students to arrive. They are trying to manage larger class sizes by having teachers become specialists.
So we have one teacher who's responsible for the reading and social studies and writing, and then the other teacher is responsible for the science and the math. So you become an expert in fewer subjects, even though you have a larger amount of students.
Everyone's on page 9, right?
Yeah. And sometimes they have children lead discussions. But the principal says that before anything can be taught,
we need to make sure that everybody's safe, that there is a place that is for learning, and that sets the tone, that sets the groundwork. And when these kids come in, they need to know we are not really concerned about your immigration status. It matters not. We want you to come in, and we want to teach you.
And she says the school will continue to welcome new students, no matter where they come from.
American Graduate is a public media initiative funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. On Saturday, most PBS stations will mark American Graduate Day with a special broadcast featuring Education Secretary Arne Duncan, celebrities like Tony Bennett and actress Allison Williams, and many others making a difference in the lives of young people.
It was an emotional night in the Bronx as one of baseball's biggest stars delivered an inspired farewell, coming at a time when professional sports and athletes have been in the headlines for troubling or even criminal behavior. Jeffrey Brown has our look.
It was the fairy tale ending to a career that's brought universal acclaim and admiration. On his last at-bat on his home field at Yankee Stadium, Derek Jeter drove in the winning run against the Baltimore Orioles. Jeter began his career in 1995 and has played 2,745 games, all as a Yankee. He holds the sixth highest hit total in baseball history, won 5 World Series rings, and was selected as an All-Star 14 times, an incredible record that he discussed at the end of the game.
I say a little prayer before every game, and, you know, I basically just said thank you because this is all I've ever wanted to do, and not too many people get an opportunity to do it. And it was above and beyond anything that I've ever dreamt of.
Tributes to his clutch play have poured in throughout his final season. Commercials like this one showed fans, rival players, and celebrities paying their respects. Jeter's final game will be on Sunday against the Red Sox in Boston.
Quite a night in New York, but also other kinds of continuing drama in the world of sports this week. We're joined by Christine Brennan, national sports columnist for USA Today and commentator for ABC News, and Mike Pesca, host of Slate's Daily News and Discussion podcast, The Gist. He's also a contributor to NPR. Well, to Derek Jeter first, Mike. It's funny he's ending his career in Boston as a Red Sox fan. I happen to know he's destroyed our hopes perhaps more than anyone, and yet he's respected there and everywhere. Why?
Yeah, because amidst the morass of immorality that sports is, unintentionally maybe poetic there. But Derek Jeter is just solid. He just is reliable, and you know, he's a little bit boring. That was his advice to Gary Sheffield when he became a Yankee, be boring. But he's boring in kind of the great ways that fathers will nudge their sons and say, look at this guy, look at how he runs it out on every play, look at how he inspires his teammates. And yeah, the commercials have gotten a little bit crazy, and the hype about Jeter, just like everything with the Yankees in sports these days, has gone over the top. But you know, fundamentally, there he is, delivering a game-winning hit in the only game he's ever played at Yankee Stadium when the playoffs weren't a possibility. So the guy's a winner, and the guy does it the right way, and it's a necessary tonic given everything else we're going to talk about.
Well, Christine, you sort of do have to see it against the everything else, right? Well, what do you think is the key?
Oh, absolutely, Jeff. And, you know, when that finish, it's a storybook finish. People will talk about that as long as they talk about the New York Yankees. That last that hit, the single, win the game, walk off, done, leave Yankee Stadium and never return. I mean, that's Ted Williams did that at Fenway Park in 1960 with his last at-bat. He hit a home run. That is still the stuff of legend in baseball. And you're right. At this time, with the NFL domestic violence story raging and the utter disgust that so many of us have for the behavior, not only of the alleged behavior in some cases of some of these athletes, but also the league, the NFL, and where are other leagues on this, to think that there's a feel-good story, a 40-year-old guy spent his entire career with one team, and he ends that way. That's pretty good stuff and comes at the exact right moment in sports in this country.
You know, Mike, there's always the other issue in this when you have a major star, aging star, of when to quit. When is the right moment, right? Some stay too long.
He nailed it. He had a terrible year this year, statistically. The Yankees were eliminated from the playoffs early. And he got paid $12 million, and people criticized him. I just want to do the math on this. The ticket brokers say the average ticket price was $850 to his last game. Yankee Stadium holds 50,000 seats. Guess what? $42 million worth of tickets. So he went out on this great note. I mean, the guy's timing. They don't call him Captain Clutch by accident.
All right, I want to move to another subject that's out there. It's really from the sublime to something quite else. And this follows the suspension of football star Ray Rice after a video became public of him punching his then-fiancée. On Wednesday night, this Wednesday night, Bill Simmons, a popular columnist for ESPN, speaking on his podcast, accused NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell of lying about whether he'd seen or known of the video previously. Let's listen to part of that.
I just think not enough is being made out of the fact that they knew about the tape and they knew it was on it. Yeah. Goodell, if he didn't know what was on that tape, he's a liar. I'm just saying it. He is lying. I think that dude is lying. If you put him up on a lie detector test, that guy would fail. And,
he's
all these
lying
people to pretend they didn't know is such f***ing bullshit. It really is. It's such f***ing bullshit. And for him to go on that press conference and pretend otherwise, I was so insulted.
Well, so after that, ESPN, his employer, suspended Simmons for 3 weeks. Christine, what's your reaction?
You know, Jeff, if I were to launch into some profane tirade, I would expect that USA Today or whoever my employer was on that broadcast, I would expect to have them tell me that it's time to take some time off. What a missed opportunity for Bill Simmons. You know, this conversation is so important in our country. And here he's got his podcast. And instead of actually having an intelligent conversation about Roger Goodell, about whether he does belong in the NFL and, you know, and should keep his job or not, which is a valid point to be bringing up. So many of us are talking about that issue. Instead of having this conversation in an intelligent manner, he goes off and does that. I'm sorry. I just think that's a huge missed opportunity for him. And he knows better. And I would expect to have the same thing happen to me if I did something like that.
And yet, Mike, a lot of reaction against ESPN and people pointing out that the suspension of Simmons was 3 weeks, which was longer than the original suspension of Ray Rice.
Yeah, I think I disagree with Christine because I think that Bill Simmons... Okay, first of all, let's not weep for him. I'm sure he's going to be paid. He runs the Grantland imprint like a publisher might have an imprint. He runs Grantland. He's quite well compensated. He's not just popular. I would say he's the most popular sports opinion voice out there. And I think this brandishes his credentials as an outsider. And I also think he knew exactly what he was doing, a clip you didn't play. He dared the bosses to suspend him, and they did. And I think it makes him look bad because it's not as if, profanity aside, and by the way, podcasts are a different form than the medium. And you're right, USA might not like that as much as ESPN does. ESPN allows a little bleeping in their podcasts. But, you know, I just think that ESPN has reported many facts that seem to indicate that Roger Goodell is being much less than truthful in this matter. And if he states it like that, a little bit raw, a little bit emotional, I think that's kind of in keeping with the forum of a podcast and the brand of Bill Simmons. I think it was an overreaction with ESPN, who is in leagues with the NFL, who gets paid. They have a $15 billion contract with the NFL, and without the business considerations, I don't see him getting suspended for that long.
Well, just in our last minute, Christine, I mean, one thing, whatever you think about this, one thing it does show certainly is the fraught relationship between a media company like ESPN and the NFL. It could have so much money involved, the partnership, and yet trying to report on it at the same time.
That's right, Jeff, and we better get used to it because it's here to stay. And these cross lines and these blurred lines, that's where we are is in media, not just obviously sports media, but all of us. And I do think that we're going to be dealing with these issues from now on. I think Bill Simmons made it really easy for ESPN to sit him out for a few weeks. And, you know, bottom line is ESPN can control who they have on their air. But it does lend to those questions about the decision making, and when you're in business with a league and then you also have journalists. I will say ESPN, who I've worked with over the years and for over the years, has done a pretty good job of keeping that separate. A few examples come to mind, and maybe this is another one, but it's a conversation we are going to have as long as there is sports television and issues in sports. There's no doubt about that.
All right. We will continue. Christine Brennan, Mike Pesca, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Welcome.
President Obama spoke out at the UN General Assembly this week for support in the fight against the Islamic State. And Attorney General Eric Holder announced his resignation. For that and a little more on Derek Jeter, we turn to the analysis of Shields and Brooks. That is syndicated columnist Mark Shields and New York Times columnist David Brooks. Welcome, gentlemen. So another word, Mark, about Derek Jeter. What else should be said about him?
Well, Judy, I think sports is, and rightly described, as a mirror of our society at large. And beyond the unspeakable wife-beating reports by some pro football players, conduct on football fields is just unacceptable. I mean, the showboating, the self-congratulatory dancing after a single tackle, the beating of the chest, and aren't I terrific, and the attempts to humiliate and embarrass your opponent. Derek Jeter, the Yankee shortstop, was the consummate professional. He showed up every day. He did his job. He never complained. He was never on TMZ. He never taunted an opponent. He was respected by them, and he respected them. There's only two teams I root for, the Boston Red Sox and the team that's playing the New York Yankees. But let me say this as a lifelong Boston Red Sox fan. He, Derek Jeter, was class. He is class in everything he's done, and he's a man of public modesty. And I just think that is so needed and missing in our society.
Class act?
And sort of a story about the limits of big data. And so Keith Olbermann has this rant, which you can, if you go on YouTube, you can see it. And he takes down Jeter's stats, and they're good. Look, by any major league standards, they're good. They're probably Hall of Fame, but they're not great. The stats are not great. His range as a shortstop was not great. And so by the statistical measure, he was not a superstar. He was a very good player, but he was not a superstar. And yet he was clearly a superstar. And he was a superstar in part because of his clutch performances and the volley and the throw to home plate during the World Series and his attitude there. But mostly he was a superstar because of the team cohesion that he built and the way he symbolized the team, the effect of one player on a team culture. One of my colleagues said the biggest number for him was the number on the back of his jersey. And that does symbolize it, that was the number that truly measured his performance as a player. Not so much the batting average, which was good, but not stellar.
Does it somehow override the other news, bad news that seems to come out of the world of sports?
It does. It stands in stark contrast and welcome contrast. And I just add the good point David made, and that is that the data, I mean, and Keith Olbermann, and which baseball now lives on, I mean, we're drowning in information, but we're thirsting for wisdom, as somebody said. And I think the wisdom is that Derek Jeter is a great baseball player. He's on his way to Cooperstown, to the Hall of Fame, as he should be, even though statistically he got more hits than anybody but five people who play the game.
So. I would just say it's always hard to know how seriously to take sports. Like, I have a friend who says the front clause of every sports story should be, not that it matters, but because I can't remember who won the World Series or the Super Bowl a couple of years later, but we get caught up in it and we debate it like we just saw them debating there, because it's where we rehearse our moral stories and debate morals and things like that.
Jackie Robinson, Branch Rickey, the desegregation of baseball before we desegregated society. I mean, that's sports.
Well, we want to turn away from sports for a minute to talk about something that happened this week. President Obama, Mark, went before the United Nations, talked about defeating the network of death, the Islamic State, appeal for the world to come support the United States. Is that speech going to make a difference in the success of this effort?
I don't know, Judy. I mean, it certainly was a speech seeking allies and making the case and making it, I thought, far more assertively, certainly, than the president did when he spoke to the nation. I mean, obviously, it was a different constituency that he was seeking. But the White House is frank that this is seeking a reset of the president's leadership credentials, of burnishing his credentials. And I do think that it was a more muscular speech or less conflicted speech. But, Judy, when you talk about destroying an ideology, I mean, Lee Hamilton, the former chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House, I was talking to this week, and he said, who writes this stuff? I mean, you don't destroy an ideology. You defeat an ideology with another ideology, with another philosophy, another point of view, in addition to content. And these people are the ideal villains. I mean, the ideal adversaries. They are the worst of humankind in their actions. But it sort of harkens back to the end of tyranny in the world, which his predecessor, George W. Bush, spoke of. There's a rhetorical overreach, I think, to this speech.
You think the president advanced the case?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was mostly revelatory about his own mind. And so he had been half measures, ambivalent, oh, I don't want to do this, reluctant. Well, clearly he took off reluctant cape this time. People have accused him, and he's been very sensitive to being called professorial and wan. And he was unwan. He was whatever the opposite
W-A-N.
Of wan.
W-A-N.
W-A-N.
Yeah.
So he was bold and forthright and simple. And he spoke, you know, he gave a speech in West Point a few months ago where he said military force is not the answer. Well, when you're fighting a military effort, military force is actually the answer. He has been stepping back some of the emphasis on democracy. He stepped that up. And so he was just more aggressive, more assertive. And I think as revelatory of his mind, I think, one, he really thinks these guys are evil. You just can't allow them to exist. Two, he does feel the responsibility to rally a coalition. You can't do it with an uncertain trumpet. And I do think they're mixed within the high rhetoric is a pretty realistic goal. We're not going to reshape the Middle East. We're not going to bring peace to Syria and Iraq. We just want to make sure the worst that could happen will not happen. And the worst is an ISIS caliphate in the middle of the Middle East.
What happened today in the House, in Parliament?
That's what I wanted to ask.
Okay, well,
They had a debate.
They did something that we're supposed to do. I mean, Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky, I give him credit, when they were going through that sham debate before they fled the city, the Congress did, encouraged by the White House. I mean, all I want to do is talk to the leaders and kind of get a wink and a nod, and we're all on board. Rand Paul said, if you're debating going to war, I would think every senator would be at his or her desk. And they aren't. And that was really refreshing and encouraging and sort of semi-inspiring to see the British today going through that and the prime minister himself fielding questions and all the rest of it. Now, let it be noted that the British agreed to go and bomb only in Iraq.
Iraq, not in Syria.
Not in Syria.
Right.
But, Judy, I mean, the absence of a debate in this country is a shame. Every member of Congress ought to be ashamed of himself, herself, that the Congress left this town without debating the most serious decision that any legislator ever makes, and that is sending other Americans into war, into possible death. And I just think it's, and I think the White House has fallen the lead of every president since. They want a free hand and the Congress to go away.
Did they show up the United States in the way they handled this?
Well, you know, I'm pro-debate. They don't have an election coming up, at least for a little while, and they do have a bipartisan agreement. Though we have a bipartisan agreement here, and I think to me what's interesting about the debate, it's less about whether than how. And so there's a pretty big majority in the country and in the Congress and in Washington that there should be some effort. The question is how. And that's a very hard to debate because we don't know if they're going to, if ISIS is going to collapse. We don't know if they're going to hang in the cities, not hang in the cities, but hang in the country. So the question is how and the methodology. And that unfurls as the war unfurls. And so now what we're doing is we're bombing their oil refineries to try to cut off some of the financial supplies, bombing some of the convoys. And we, the country will have to react. And having a running debate as the war essentially widens, which it's going to do, that, having that debate as the war widens, that seems to me the crucial moment.
So it's okay to wait.
Well, I'm pro debate. You know, this is what I do for a living, so why should I mind? But I agree with Mark's points. I'm just saying it's very hard to have the debate about how, what's effective, what's ineffective, right, until we actually see some evidence.
Well, you can figure out, first of all, how you're going to pay for it. I mean, General Dempsey today admitted, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, said, we're going to run out of money on this. The Pentagon's going to run out of money. And the bombing is antiseptic. But Barry Goldwater, God bless him, said, when you're thinking about bombing, this is in Vietnam and it's true today, you've got to forget this thing, the civilian, because when you bomb, you kill civilians. I mean, the idea that you're just hitting oil installations. There are human beings who work at that oil installations who aren't members of Al-Qaeda or ISIL or anybody else. So, I mean, these are acts that have long-term repercussions.
Right. And in fact, Dempsey made it sound like they're making more progress than we realized. I do want to reserve the last few minutes to ask you about the Attorney General, Eric Holder. David, surprised, I think, most people announcing he's going to step down. What's the legacy? He's had his detractors. He's had his admirers.
Yeah, he's got detractors and admirers on both left and right. More admirers on the left, obviously, and more dislike on the right. But what has been said about him, which I think is the essential truth, is that he was quite strong on civil rights and not so strong on civil liberties. And so if you look at the record, especially in terms of incarceration, sentencing, Voting Rights Act, very, very aggressive. And I'd like to especially highlight the incarceration, which, you know, mm-hmm. I think is out of control in this country. And so his efforts there are much appreciated. On the civil liberties, on the national security, he was very heavy on national security and not as respectful of civil liberties. And if you're worried about terrorism, then, and if you're respecting the Bush administration, he followed a lot of those precedents and took them further. And the one thing I really do object to, and this is parochial, is his incredibly aggressive assault on the press. The Associated Press reporters, the Fox News commentators, going after the records and the phone records, that seemed to me appalling. But that was of a piece of his national security approach.
I agree in great part. I mean, I do commend him for the civil rights, not simply for gay and lesbian people, which he did champion, but also the attempts, quite frankly, by new Republican administrations in states after the 2010 sweep to suppress voter turnout in minority communities. And he took them on, and I commend him for that. I think that he'll be held accountable in history's judgment for too big to jail. After the Wall Street collapse, after the savings and loan crisis in the late 80s, Judy, 1,000 bankers and directors were indicted. 100 of them did time in jail. Not a single one of these CEOs or these people who brought the country to its knees, who destroyed people's futures. And so it was always going to be a fine, but you'll do no time. And I really do think, corporations don't serve time. Corporations don't go away. And I really think that was a failure.
A thought on the Wall Street piece of his
legacy. I think so. You'd have to figure out who did what. I mean, that was always the challenge. So it's possible there was stupidity more than crime. There was clearly fraud in the banking sector. But you pick out the executives who did something wrong. A lot of it was just stupidity and ignorance.
Immunity leads to impunity. And that's exactly, I think, the attitude of the financial community.
All right. We thank you both. Mark Shields, David Brooks. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Again, the major developments of the day. The U.S. military said airstrikes have disrupted the command and control and logistics of Islamic State forces in Syria. The British House of Commons voted to join the air campaign in Iraq, but not in Syria. And Ferguson, Missouri remained on edge after new unrest over the killing of a black teenager by a white police officer. Tonight, PBS will air a special, America After Ferguson. Check your local listings. Before we go tonight, we want to mark a milestone here at the NewsHour. Linda Winslow, our executive producer, is retiring. It's not overstating it to say Linda has been the lifeblood of this program, dating back to the first days of the Robert McNeil Report. She was one of its two original producers. And as the program has grown and evolved into what you see here today, she has been its heart and soul.
She really has been and is the essence of what the NewsHour represents. Linda sets the standard. She expects the best from all of us and is such a keen editor. She's made every one of us better journalists, including the many reporters and producers who passed through our doors whose work she touched. With Jim Lehrer and Robin McNeil, Linda created our brand of reporting. Treat the audience as intelligent and curious. Be fair and be civil.
Linda, saying thank you does not begin to cover it. We are all so grateful, happy for your new freedom, there you are, and also a little bit sad. We may be losing your daily wisdom, but you'll never lose our friendship.
From the morning meeting to your nightly spot in the control room, you have led us with a strong guiding hand through news, big and small. We are going to miss you a lot. And even your voice in our ears telling us to wrap it up, which is what I'm hearing right now.
Which is, I think, what she's saying right now. So I guess we will wrap it up. That's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Gwen Ifill.
And I'm Judy Woodruff. Have a great weekend. Thank you. And good night.
Major funding for the PBS NewsHour has been provided by Charles Schwab, proud supporter of the PBS NewsHour, BNSF Railway, and by BAE Systems, inspired work. Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. At carnegie.org. And with the ongoing support of these institutions. And friends of the NewsHour.
This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.